scientific and technological advice on how to conduct a civil war, and that he went to and consulted with prominent scientists, and here are some of them. Louis Agassiz, Benjamin Pierce, Joseph Henry again, Jimmy Taylor. And he asked them for help. Well, it's all untrue. These five people were leaders of something called the scientific Lazzaroni. Why Lazzaroni? Well, you have to go back and look at the hospital in Rome, St. Lazarus. This is where poor people would spend the night. They had a home. And what did these guys want? They were basically jealous of their European counterparts. They had the Royal Society, the French Academy. And they said, we need something similar to that. So they went to Lincoln and said, if you will create a National Academy of Science, we will help you win the war. And he went along with it. Of course, that's the headquarters today. How do they help? They did. As far as anybody can tell, they made no contribution. Civil War ends. And the Academy has achieved nothing. And it doesn't have any money. So it's about to go out of existence. Joseph Henry was one of the prominent members of the Academy. Had the good fortune to die. And he left his estate to the Academy. His wife had died first. Not with the Academy. So the National Academy survived. Let's move a little bit further forward. When I mentioned disease is one of the principal drivers of government policy. Here's an example. 1878, this is what's going on. Let me give you a few historic points. There were 20,000 deaths. It actually turned out to be yellow fever. But no one understood that they were going to be involved. So quarantine. They established a National Board of Health to figure out how to quarantine people. And then the National Academy was asked to develop a National Public Health Organization. And once again, the Academy fell flat on its face. Achieved nothing. This is how it was. There was a huge amount of infighting. National Board of Health, Marine Health Service, Army Medical Corps. It was a mess. The Marine Health Service actually wound up being one of the major players in this. In 1887, they created something called the Hygienic Laboratory. I'm going to show you about that in a few minutes. That story begins with someone by the name of Joseph Kim, who studied medicine in New York City. His father had been a medical doctor. The family was actually in the father's they lived in Tennessee and fought on the side of the Confederacy. War ends. They moved to they lost everything and moved to Missouri. And Joseph Kenyon comes to New York to study medicine. He gets his medical degree. And he goes back to Missouri and discovers he doesn't want to. He wants to do something more significant than patients. He wants to study disease. He wants to understand what it was. So I mentioned the Marine Health Service, 1887. They had a facility on Staten Island. And Kenyon basically said, can you do something? I want to work on studying disease, something that we call microbiology today. And so they gave him a room. That building, and that is the beginning of U.S. medical research. It happened because there was somebody seriously interested, committed, and was able to persuade somebody to give you a little space. And he made progress. 1891, 4 years later, they moved the whole hygienic laboratory to the Butler Mansion in Washington. That's a picture building. And Kenyon, because he was so successful, was actually given the entire top floor. So the NIH story continues. Again, now it intersects war. Disease, war. Spanish-American War in 1898, there were 10 times as many soldiers who died of disease that they contracted during the war than in battlefield injuries. Think about it. World War I. Same thing. Disease is killing the military. 1818. It was the beginning of the influenza pandemic. There were actually 13,000 cases in Washington, D.C. Washington was not a big city. 1820. While all this is going on, not much is happening. People wringing their hands. What do we do about it? Yeah, Kenyon had started his laboratory, which doing research. 1829 was the second outbreak, but what happened there? Members of Congress got sick. So a year later, the Ramsdale Act passed, establishing the National Institute of Health. And by the way, it was unique. This is the first time the federal government actually provided money for scientific study in the form of government. And of course, that's what the NIH campus looks like today. So it's a series of things that happened that intersected war, disease, somebody who was just desirous of doing research rather than simply dealing with patients. Okay, let's go back to the National Academy again. So having failed twice, there's another opportunity. 1884, Congress established the Joint Commission, known as the Allison Commission, asked a series of questions about science. This is still in formative days. Should the government support research that does not have any practical or demonstrative application? In other words, do you have applied research? Is that what the government should be supporting? If it doesn't, should it have a direct conflict, a direct voice in evaluating scientific projects? Should the federal government establish a part of science? Oversee everything. Should there be a science advisory committee? And these are all questions that are still debated. This is 1884. And of course, one final one, even though we weren't spending very much money, most of it's aimed at disease in the military, shoot isn't too much. So the National Academy of Sciences decides to get involved in this. And they provide answers to all of these questions. What did Congress do with them? With the report that the Academy provided? Essentially what Nancy Pelosi did in the State of the Union of Freshman Support on the Social Services. So now the Academy is 0-3. And it still does not have a firm base of financial support. All right. Let me move on a little bit to something else. Just to give you the context of how things are developing. Last year, there was a movie, a terrible review. It was called The Current War. And this was the movie poster. It was in the cinema July 26th. And it featured Benedict Cumberbatch, who actually is a wonderful actor and meeting him a few years ago. Then Michael Shannon and Nick Holt, they played Thomas Edison, George Westinghouse, and Nikola Tesla. How many of you heard about the current war? So I'm going to show you a little bit more about it. This was a movie. replace the sign from 1886 to 1894, Nikola Tesla on one side and Thomas Edison on the other. It was basically AC versus DC. And there's a fascinating story about this because Nikola Tesla had the support of George Westinghouse, somebody who's an investor, technologist. That's a good thing. Edison had the support of J.P. Morgan. And I ask you to think about who had more clout. More money. So things are marginal. These guys are at each other's throats. There was a project being built to generate electricity in Niagara Falls, and they were vying for the contract for this. And I'm not going to tell you all the boring details about what happened, but it involved somebody being fried in an electric chair in not a very pleasant fashion. Long story short, and it was a setup. They were making use of people to try to win it, make sure the other side was not getting good publicity. Along comes the Columbia Exposition in Chicago in 1893, and this was the biggest World's Fair, and it'll light it up using electricity. And so the World's Fair, the exposition people, got proposals from Tesla, Westinghouse, and from Edison, Morgan. And Westinghouse basically said, we're going to do it for no cost. In fact, we're going to lose our shirts, but we're going to put Edison and Morgan out of business. They got the contract. They lit up the exposition. That was AC. Now, I mentioned this, and I'll tell you the end of the story in a moment, but I mentioned this for a reason. If there had been any kind of mechanism for making a decision about whether you do AC versus DC, those of you who are physicists who know something about electricity will know that you can't easily, at least you can do it now, but you couldn't do it back then, you could not transmit electricity at high voltage between low, on, and across. And then change the voltage, you had to be using transformers, AC. But there were no standards. New York City back then was all DC. This changed it. This tested it. Westinghouse went broke. Morgan said, you know something? AC is better than DC. So he took over the whole company and became General Electric. That's what General Electric. But we didn't have any way of making decisions. There was no agency, no department, nothing. This was all, whatever the hell the private sector wants to do, it's going to happen. Even if it affects the health and safety of the population. All right, so now we move forward a little bit to 1900. And in the aftermath of that and a bunch of other things, there are decisions made you have to have, and by the way, standards are built into the Constitution. So we're going to have a Bureau of Standards that is actually going to set the ground rules for what we do. So that was the Bureau of Standards established March 3rd, 1901. It was in downtown Washington, not far from the Capitol, you can see it on the left. Moved up to the west side, northwest part of the city in 1903. And expanded in that area, and then finally it was renamed in 1980 National Institute of Standards and Technology, by which time there were over three campuses, Gaithersburg, Maryland, 1952, Gaithersburg, Maryland, and Boulder, Colorado. That's the history of NIST. And again, done because back in the 30th century, we had no mechanism for making decisions. Back to the war. So we had a civil war. Science and technology really did not play much of a role, although we did have the Battle of the Monitor and Merrimack, but it was small-scale stuff.
China isn't playing a role. World War One was there. World War One is really the first technology war. This was the birth of aeronautics. And had a major impact on what the United States did, because we had no air power to speak of. And as the war was progressing, people began to realize we don't have the technology to do that. And so it led to the development of a lot of these remarkable technologies that we now, and the companies that we now have, can trace back to World War I. All right, let's keep going. Who recognizes that image? Herbert Hoover. So most people remember Herbert Hoover as a failed president who, when the Great Depression hit, had no solutions. Let me show you something about Herbert Hoover. First of all, Herbert Hoover is an engineer. And this is taken from the New York Times in 1926. Hoover leads group raising $20 million to aid in pure science. He was the first president to say it's important for the United States to be a leader in scientific research. Whatever he might have achieved, of course, the opportunity disappeared with the Depression. And so what we remember him for was his inability to really do anything about this horrible economic situation. But he really had, this is what he wanted. If the Depression hadn't occurred, who knows? That might have been the start. But it was still born, because the country went into horrible economic spiral. Of course, then comes along World War II. And Franklin Roosevelt on the left, and Harry Truman on the right, Roosevelt, president when the war in the United States joined in 1941. Of course, he was involved in the Middle East beforehand. And then Truman, somebody by the name of Van Abram Bush, who was an engineer from MIT. And Bush, upper left, was head of what was called OSRD, Office of Scientific Research and Development. Basically had control all of the technology in the Second World War. And he was bosom buddies with Roosevelt. He was, without question, a remarkable person, not only in his scientific and technological skills, but also organizational. Truly remarkable person. He also was very much of a visionary. And the question was,